Today on Doomed!
You know, I attended this talk. The audience was overwhelmingly enthusiastic of Bernie Sanders. They have a really young, charismatic, if we can still say that word.
For black people mayor. Who aren't familiar with that mention, you will understand why we're laughing very soon.
Yeah.
Brianna Joy Gray joins the show to discuss the brouhaha surrounding what Bernie Sanders said about Barack Obama and the Democratic Party while speaking at an event to honor Martin Luther King in Jackson, Mississippi. Folks, she was there! This and much more on today's episode of Doomed with Matt Binder. Hello, everyone. We have quite the show for you this week. I have to say, between the insanity surrounding this event and what Bernie Sanders did and did not say at it, and, well, at least for me personally, this past weekend being WrestleMania weekend, my adrenaline is just pumping. So let's keep this rush going by getting this show some more reviews on iTunes. See what I did there? You like that? More reviews mean more listeners. The show goes up the iTunes charts, gets in front of more eyes. Can you believe that? Anyway, as of this recording, the show is at 69 total reviews. I know. Part of me wants to keep it, right at that number. Just keep it right there. But let's start heading towards some of the other magic numbers too. Maybe 420 reviews or 666 reviews. If you like what you hear on the show, consider supporting it monetarily. You can do that now. For only $5 a month, you can help this show grow over at patreon.com/mattbinder. This is the first month of Patreon for Doomed, so I will soon be rolling out some bonuses for Patreon eyes and ears only. And now that all that's out of the way... Joining us now on the show is Brianna Joy Gray. She is an attorney, a contributing editor at Current Affairs, and co-host of SWOTY, Someone's Wrong on the Internet podcast. Brianna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
Now, I am thrilled to have you on this show. I had reached out to you a while back, wanted to have you on, and just things happened and it didn't happen, but now it's happening, and you know what? It's like... the universe worked out the best case scenario because I cannot think of a more perfect person to have on right now at this very moment with what's currently going on.
Unfortunately, I think that you're right. There's quite the Twitter storm going on right now.
It's stunning to me that this is happening right now. And we'll talk about more than just this. But it's crazy to me that it's 2018. And a loud, and I don't think they're so big, I don't think their numbers are so big, but a loud and influential, at least online, segment of the centrist Democrats, the Hillary Clinton wing of the party, if that even exists anymore, the hashtag still with her contingent of people. And basically, why don't you set the stage for us? You were at the event, right?
I was at the event. So I was actually very lucky to spend quite a bit of time with Senator Sanders on Wednesday. I started with him in Memphis, where he gave some brief remarks and marched with Jesse Jackson and a bunch of other leaders from the Black community to commemorate, obviously, Martin Luther King's 50 years of his assassination there. And I was able to travel with him and his cohort to Jackson, where he had been invited by Mayor Lumumba there to give a talk, also commemorating Martin Luther King's life and legacy. Specifically, that talk, something that's not really been highlighted at all by any of the press, the subject of it was explicitly economic justice. And it's a beautiful talk that everyone should listen to because it shows exactly what kind of unity of interest there continues to be between Martin Luther King, Bernie Sanders, and a lot of progressive people, including a lot of people in a town that you wouldn't necessarily think would be so embracing of progressive politics, Jackson, Mississippi. So I attended this talk. It was a beautiful night. The audience was overwhelmingly enthusiastic of Bernie Sanders. They have a really young, charismatic, if we can still say that word, black
mayor.
For
people who aren't familiar with what you're with that mention, you will understand why we're laughing very soon.
Yeah. So he got a standing ovation when Bernie Sanders did when he came out. He got a standing ovation when he left. There were applause lines throughout. So I went to sleep that night. And when I woke up the next morning, I was shocked to find that people had perverted this beautiful event into another kind of hot take. And the hot take was that people were upset that Bernie Sanders had said that the Democratic Party had been had a failing strategy for the last 15 years. I failed to see the lie, and the audience agreed. They applauded immediately after he said that, one of the loudest applause lines of the night. And he went on to say that perhaps the fact that the Democratic Party was led by someone as charismatic and brilliant as Barack Obama disguised the fact or made it less obvious that the party wasn't doing very well. But in fact, here we are. This seemed to me at the time to be a completely uncontroversial subject. But subsequently, a BuzzFeed reporter who was there tweeted just those lines out of context. And the 8%ers on Twitter who want to construe everything as negatively as possible when it comes to Bernie Sanders took it and really ran with it. And we saw people characterizing his remarks. So I think a lot of people didn't even just read the remarks straight. They saw the characterization. And the characterizations did things like say, Bernie Sanders says that Barack Obama is merely charismatic, right? They inject, in fact, the New York Times reporter who was also there, Jonathan Martin, in his article, he injects the word merely before the quote, right? Like that completely didn't exist in any kind of subtext of what Senator Sanders right. said, right?
Right.
So this is sort of an incredible Twitter storm. It's one more reason why people are out here claiming that Bernie Sanders going to an 85% black city to commemorate Dr. King when nobody else was there. nobody else was in. No other national political figures that I saw were in Memphis who weren't black civil rights activists themselves. Right. This somehow was a point of criticism for him.
Now, for people who aren't familiar with why you called this group of people who are just finding this to be so abhorrent, the 8%ers, basically, there was a poll that came out that said something like only 8% of Democrats disapprove of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. So he's overwhelmingly popular.
Right. And polls show, too, that something like 77%, and I think that's on the low end, of black Americans approve of Bernie Sanders.
That's right. I believe that black folks approve of him more than any other ethnic group. And I think the only group that approves of him more might be women.
Right. Those Bernie bros.
Right. As a black woman, I can say that I'm completely on board with these these poll results.
Now, stunningly to me, people are confused as to, you know, they hear that stuff and they think to themselves, how is this true? This can't be accurate, because Hillary Clinton, especially in states in the South where black people have much more of the voting share than in other states, they overwhelmingly voted for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 primary. And it's really shocking to me that people can't understand that, yeah, you can like two people, but decide, you know what, I know who this other person is, and I'm more comfortable with them, they have more of a history with my community, so I feel like there's more of a connection there. So while I like both of them, I'm going to vote for this person, but I still like the other person too.
Yeah, there's this real strange logical lapse that's been happening since 2016, in which people, I think, have become comfortable with treating the black vote as kind of a bellwether, because during general elections, because of the way the Republican Party has historically chosen to adopt the Southern strategy and use race baiting as part of how they win and showing a real strong identity of interest with white voters. You know, you can predict who basically the not racist party is by virtue of who the majority of black voters vote for. But that doesn't mean that those that same logic can apply in a Democratic primary. Whether or not the bulk of black voters, you know, chooses one person or another in a primary doesn't necessarily correspond to whether or not the other party is, you know, Bull Connor the way that it does in a general election. And I think that people really have amnesia about the fact that I think some poll from the end of 2015 put Bernie Sanders as getting an estimated 2% of the primary vote. He had very low name recognition. I frankly kept confusing him with Barney Frank.
Wow.
Like I was so out of it. You know what I mean? Like,
I can tell you who would not be happy to hear that. Barney Frank.
I know. So here we are, where people have completely forgotten that, you know, Bernie's kind of rise to kind of national you know, familiarity was something that happened very quickly and unevenly. And of course, people had a lot more familiarity with Hillary Clinton, who was not only the first lady of the United States of America for 8 years, she was the first lady of a Southern state before that.
Right.
So I think that people also kind of ignore the fact that for very good reasons, black voters, you know, can be, I think, sometimes more risk averse than other voting populations, partly because we've historically been so vulnerable. And these votes have had very serious and immediate implications for some very basic civil rights. And I say that with a lot of like compassion and understanding. But that also means that if there's a newcomer, someone like Bernie Sanders, to whom a lot of people was a complete mystery, then it makes perfect sense to me why voters would vote for Hillary Clinton. And I don't think it was necessarily I obviously disagree, but I don't think it was an illogical or dumb decision or anything like that. But the thing is, things change. People learn more about candidates, particularly when they take the time to go down south and visit and, you know, take a 3-hour car drive out of their way to go and visit your city and the poor state of the union and speak to you about how an economic justice platform can help close the wealth gap, particularly right. The racial wealth gap.
Right. And you know, listen, I could say right now, as a Bernie Sanders supporter, voted for him in the primary, very critical of Hillary Clinton during the election, I did end up voting for her in the general election versus Donald Trump. I felt like, yeah, I live in New York. I didn't have to. It would have made no difference. But I did feel like it was something I needed to do. I did feel strongly about that. And I, again, was probably one of the most critical people of her online. I did so under the Working Families Party ticket, so I can give them that extra vote they need to continue to get on the ballot. But as someone who is critical of her, I can say, to the Clintons' credit, they have, over many, many years, have a longstanding a connection with the black community all over the country, especially in the South. And for someone like Bernie Sanders, who never thought he was going to win, thought he was literally just in this race from the beginning to push Clinton to the left, and wasn't until literally the first month in 2016, I believe, did they realize through their different polls and whatever they do to figure out how what their chances are, they were like, oh, we have a real shot. Yeah. And then Southern states voted literally the next month. So you're asking someone to basically make up for decades that the Clintons had ahead of him in terms of that connection with the black community in 1 month.
Yeah. I think what's really funny is that they actually he couldn't do it in a month. Obviously, that makes sense. Nobody would expect, you know, as far as he got, as far as he did, rather, was kind of miraculous. But I'll tell you what, a year and a half later, walking down Beale Street in Memphis, Tennessee, with him, going into a barbecue restaurant, you know, walking around Jackson, Mississippi, and seeing how people approached him after the talk, I was actually blown away by how overwhelmingly positive the response was in these predominantly black spaces. Because to be honest, you know, I know how I feel about Senator Sanders. I've been a supporter of his for some time. I I guess, have on some level bought in to the Twitter sphere 8%er notion that, okay, maybe Black people at very least just don't know who he is as much, let's say, or you know even if it's not the hatred that the people online would allege it is, I thought, okay, well, maybe people will just be kind of indifferent or just, you know, vaguely curious but not particularly enthusiastic. But people, we tried to walk from a parking garage to a restaurant about a block. And I want to say it took, you know, 10-15 minutes, because every few steps, all kinds of people, young teenage boys, young Black boys, you know, old Black women, young, you know, white teenagers from Ole Miss. There was a whole rainbow panoply of people who were coming up to him. And I would gather, partly because of the demographics of Beale Street and Memphis, and the fact that, you know, it was a commemorative day celebrating Dr. King, the majority of the people were Black. And not only did they come up with him to him to want to take a picture, but teenage boys were saying things like, oh my goodness, this is the guy. This is the guy who, you know, remembers who voted for him. This is the guy who stands up for their people. And as Senator Sanders would walk down the street, I would hang back and hear people having these editorial conversations about, yeah, that's a guy who's really looking out for the working people. I mean, you couldn't have scripted it better than this. And I was genuinely surprised by the proportion of people who genuinely seemed to have internalized this message, but I shouldn't have been, because it was so consistent. And I think, frankly, that Senator Sanders knows that, and that might be part of the reason why he has been not as quick to respond, I think, to some of the criticisms that he needs to change the way he approaches audiences. Because I can see how, from his perspective, the people on the ground, the people in working class communities like Jackson, who are actually engaging with him and responding to him, you know, everyone from the receptionists at the hotel he checked into, and, you know, every single person we engaged with was just so positive and supportive, including, you know, reams and reams of Black people, that I think that on some level he might not appreciate how different the world looks when you're looking at it through a computer screen.
Right. I've noticed that same thing. You're online, you see this barrage of these 8%ers, and you're thinking, oh wow, maybe I'm overplaying my hand in terms of how much Bernie is supported. And then you literally walk outside, and so yeah, many people have an opinion that's positive of him. Listen, I don't expect them to vote for him, obviously, and they're not. But I've even heard from some of my, you know, on Facebook, when I see like I barely use it, but when I go on there and I see someone back from high school who's one of my few friends who ended up being a conservative, they may think he's crazy for being a socialist, but they all say, but I have to say, he seems like he's a real honest guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's inescapable. It really hits you in the face. I mean, the other thing that really was striking was he was in Jackson, Mississippi. I didn't know how much a kind of socialist message was going to hit. Like, I had my own biases and preconceptions going into it. But he was standing on stage with a 35 or 36-year-old Black mayor who, at some point in his remarks, defends socialism explicitly. And then the two go on to talk about how, instead of courting Amazon to bring business to Mississippi, they should, you know, Bernie Sanders was talking about how they had a model of co-op grocery stores in Vermont when they couldn't get big stores to come and fill in food deserts and provide the needs of certain communities, because it wasn't profitable enough there. And so they're workshopping these kinds of things on stage. You know, there was such an identity of interest between these two people who were told should be different because of their personal ethnic identities or because of their different age demographics. And it really showed how universal the message of the kinds of universal programs that Sanders supports genuinely is. And I think, frankly, I mean, the reason why he gets so much pushback in the press is because, absent that, he would be president, you know, and the powers that be, all this always sounds a little conspiracy theory-ish, but the reality is that you know, absent the kind of corporate influence of the Bacardi Sellers of the world, who is out here photographed with his arm around.
Rest in peace, Bernie Sanders campaign, April. You saw that tweet?
Right, yes. So he's out here at AIPAC with his arm around a bunch of Republicans talking about he knows who a real progressive is. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, like the people like him have to be out here defending the party line, because otherwise his message is just so obvious to the people on the ground who are actually living the lives impacted by a kind of a corporatist neoliberal worldview.
Right. And I'm going to play that clip here in question, the one we were talking about from that event in Jackson, Mississippi, just so we could sort of get it, you know, in context, hear everything together.
Senator Sanders, this is for you. We saw a surge of millennials supporting you. How are you? How are you harnessing that energy to engage and sustain millennials in Jackson, Mississippi? And how are you doing the same to reimagine the Democratic Party?
The business model, if you like, of the Democratic Party for the last 15 years or so has been a failure. Now, what happened, people sometimes don't see that because there was a charismatic individual named Barack Obama who won the presidency in 2008 and 2012. And he was obviously an extraordinary candidate, brilliant guy. But behind that reality, over the last 10 years, Democrats have lost about 1,000 seats in state legislatures all across this country. And you got significant numbers of states like Mississippi, where the governor, the legislature, the senators are all Republicans. Okay. Now, how does this happen?
Now, I just want to repeat the question there, because I think people are seeing this quote on Twitter, and they're thinking that Bernie went to this event, this somber event honoring Martin Luther King on the day of his assassination, and just randomly decided, and by the way, I hate Obama or something like that. The question is, we saw a surge of millennials support you. How are you harnessing that energy to engage and sustain millennials in Jackson, Mississippi? And how are you doing the same to reimagine the Democratic Party? And
right.
So then Bernie Sanders goes on to say that, like you said, and like we heard in the clip, the party has been a failure for the last 15 years. And then he goes on to say, and I really don't see this as a backhanded compliment at all. Like people are
It's saying, really not.
It's that he says that we were blinded to how bad the Democratic Party was doing because the leader of the party was so charismatic. He was so likable. And
right.
Then he goes on to say in that next line after calling him charismatic, he was obviously an extraordinary candidate. Again, talking about when he ran for election in 2008 and then 2012 re-election, he was an extraordinary candidate. So good
right.
that even in re-election, we were able to say, we're going with this guy again. Even though the Democratic Party was already went through a 2010 midterm where the Tea Party decimated them.
Right.
And then what? He says yeah. he's a brilliant guy.
Yep.
Now, I got to say, if my enemies called me charismatic, extraordinary, and brilliant, I think I would have to become friends with them.
Yeah, that enemy could be my reference for my next job.
I mean, and people don't seem to realize that when Barack Obama was like Bernie Sanders supported Obama when Obama ran for election.
Yep.
And Barack Obama did the same for Bernie. There's clips out there of each of them endorsing each other for Bernie when he was running for Senate.
For Senate, yeah.
Yeah. And then Obama. We all know that Obama preferred Hillary Clinton. That's no surprise, but that's because he felt she was closer in line with his politics. He didn't dislike Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, and in fact, who knows what was going on there, what kind of pact he signed on to get her to relax and stop making threats, you know, all those references she kept making to Kennedy after she had to drop out of the primary right. in 2008. You know, who knows what blood bond they came to, what agreement they came to get her to chill out and to accept his primary victory.
You know, I still think, and a lot of people disagree, and I'll explain why I think this. I still think the 2008 primary between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton was more brutal.
Of course it was.
I will add an addendum that I think the supporters of Bernie versus the supporters of Hillary is more brutal than the supporters of Obama versus the supporters of Hillary in 2008. But the actual campaigns, I mean, we have to remember the worst thing Bernie Sanders said about her was, and again, a lot of people don't remember the quantifiers. He said he called her unqualified. You remember that speech where everyone was like, oh, I can't believe he went there, where he went over and over again saying she was unqualified. But no one remembers that in that speech he's saying she's unqualified if she supports this. And she's unqualified if she supports that. It was, again, him pushing her. He never outright said she's unqualified.
Not only that, but Clinton called him unqualified first.
I'll be fair. I don't think she called him unqualified. I think she was asked, if I remember correctly, she was asked if she thought Bernie Sanders was qualified. And she basically did one of her laughing things. Yeah. But did she say, I don't think she ever said, no, I don't think. I think she, did her thing where she shrugged her shoulders. You know, it was a non-answer where you can basically, take it as you will. You could take it either way. Yeah.
It's like when she was asked if Barack Obama was a Muslim, and she said, I don't know, you have to ask him.
Right.
Kind of like that, right?
Right. But, it's...
A lot of integrity back in it.
And that would always bother me, and again, we're going back here, but I think it all really ties in. It always bothered me, because I think the people who hate Bernie, this loud group, is viewing everything, obviously, with, tinted glasses. They're seeing things that no normal human being are seeing. Like, I remember when he endorsed her, and he went through all the things, if you were against, if you care about climate change, as everyone in my campaign fought so hard to make an issue of, then this is why you should support Hillary Clinton. And if you're against the Dakota Pipeline, like I am and like all of us are, then let me explain to you why you should support Hillary Clinton. And there were people, I remember, going, oh my God, look at him. He's making this about him. He's bringing up, how his campaign was fighting the 1% and Wall Street. That's what an endorsement is. I was there at the DNC when he made that endorsement. And I was watching and I was saying to myself, this is a brilliant endorsement for this specific scenario, because he's telling his supporters, who at this point are distraught that he's not winning.
Right.
And he's telling them, this is what we've done. We've changed the ball game here. And this is,
it's not about him at all. He's directing attention from him and putting it on the issues and reminding the people, you were with me because you believed in these things. This alternative candidate also believes in these things, and so you should transfer your allegiance from me to her. That's the least selfish thing that you could do.
Exactly. It was such a good endorsement. I'm sitting here almost speechless remembering it. Speechless, remembering maybe the endorsement, which was so great, but actually speechless remembering the criticisms of it.
That's how you know it's not real. Because when you're on the ground, when you're actually watching him, when you're interacting with him, nobody thinks these things. And then you wake up the next morning or you log into your phone and suddenly there's this whole mythology that's been invented around him. And it's happened so many times that frankly, I'm about to be on board with his what seems to come off as kind of this indifferent kind of aloof attitude about it all and not even try, because it really feels like there's nothing he can do. If you go to Jackson, Mississippi, to speak to the needs of the blackest state in the United States of America, the poorest state in the United States of America, in a city that is 81 or 85 or whatever it is percent black, to commemorate a black civil rights hero and talk about all of the ways in which your personal career or your struggle, career as a politician, and the reason that you even got into politics is because you believe so strongly in his economic justice ideals. If you, Bernie Sanders, sit here and talk to those ideals for an hour underneath a Martin Luther King quote that says, "True compassion is more than flipping a coin to the beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring." And to stand in front of a room of people who all have simpatico on that ideology, come into standing applause, lead to standing applause, you know, and then wake up the next day and find that the story is not about substantive issue of restructuring that edifice, but about a fabricated slight that people are mad that you complimented as brilliant, the first black president of the United States of America, then like, how can you win?
Right. You know, he was literally saying, like, if Obama wasn't so good, then maybe people would realize just how bad the Democratic Party was. He was literally, and you know what?
He's the only non-failing part of the Democratic Party.
And you know what? So many people on the left probably even disagree with him about that.
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of people were arguing it's completely natural to lose 1,000 seats in 8 years.
Oh,
you know,
my God.
There's always these ebbs and flows and swings, and that's true. I pulled up because I specifically found a Slate article by Jamel Bowie, because a lot of the people here really, you know, a lot of the 8%ers really respect him and other members of kind of like the black pundit class. That was the title of the article, something like "A Nearly Unprecedented Loss in Legislative Seats." And I was like, look, your guy, the guy you like, has even characterized it the exact same way. But again, it's not about what's being said. It's about the fact that it's coming from from Bernie Sanders. And there are people who are going to do anything it takes to make sure that no one's talking about the edifice that needs restructuring.
Can you imagine, though, saying to yourself, like, oh, no, this just happens every 8 years, you know? Okay, no problem. We'll just, you know, we'll get rid of Trump, and then we'll have a Democratic president again. And then after 8 years on from that, my kids will just deal with Donald Trump all over again.
You know, and what's really galling is, you remember all that talk about, oh, Bernie Sanders isn't supporting down ballot races. You know, what about all of these other communities? What about the South? Oh, he doesn't care about the South. I mean, the Democratic Party is a party that has made a choice, a conscious choice, to abandon, to not pursue a 50-state solution. And this is something that Sanders talked about in the speech that apparently no one's actually listening to. And he was talking about the fact that you can't ignore states like Mississippi. And he pointed out the fact that Mississippi, because it's 37% black, has a real shot at turning blue with a very small percentage of the white population. And he pointed out that without any funding, any effort, really, that Barack Obama won 44% of the vote there, I believe in 2012, it might have been 2008, and that he's the only one who's looking to these communities and not abandoning communities. But somehow the rhetoric that then becomes Bernie Sanders is paying attention to red states because he cares about racists, aka Trump voters, more than he does people. And what I really love about this whole Mississippi example is that he's completely turned that logic on its head, because here we are in the blackest red state, and people still have found a reason, now an even more artificial, constructed reason, to be upset with him.
Can you imagine, though, like, listen, I know Trump supporters are bad in terms of, like, how can you do this or whatever, but can you imagine, though, thinking that almost 63 million people in this country are Nazis, basically. Like, 63 yeah. million people voted for Donald Trump. And there's a significant portion of them who, I can tell you right now, are feeling duped.
Yeah, this is an interesting subject, because I was just having this conversation with a friend of mine at work just now, actually. And So Sanders runs into trouble here too, because I agree with that the characterization of Trump voters as racist is overly simplistic and ultimately not constructive. And I've written about this before, I think most recently in Rolling Stone. But you know, I think it's also very important to say, of course, Trump is racist. Of course, Trump says racist things, and of course, many people who voted for Trump are racist and were attracted to Trump. Some were attracted to Trump because of his racism. The point that I like to make is that a lot of Democrats are racist too. And so stop me if you've heard me say this before, but there was a poll that went around in 2016 that everyone very gleefully circulated that talked about how Trump voters were the most racist of all people. But while the results of that poll were often often extrapolated for articles, people saying, oh, you know, 40% of Trump voters think that black people have a bad work ethic, or, you know, 30-odd percent of Trump voters think that black people are less intelligent than white people, including apparently Sam Harris, but never mind. what you also saw in the poll was that, you know, 30% of Clinton voters also thought that black people were less intelligent. And, you know, 25% of Hillary voters also thought that black people, you know, were more violent or whatever the numbers were. I mean, there would maybe be a 10-15 point gap, but the numbers were still there. And in fact, even though he's often left off of the poll results, Bernie Sanders voters were the least racist of all voters. So my issue here is that there are racists in every voting population, but it has never been a litmus test for whether or not, as a politician, you should try to appeal to them and, you know, win elections. And the issue is that you have to make sure that people understand that appealing to these populations doesn't mean you're capitulating to racial stereotypes or playing to their sense of bias or bigotry. The Sanders innovation, Sanders revelation, is that you can actually reach out to people on a different axis, and that whether you're racist or not, whether you're a racist Democrat or not, whether you're a racist Republican or not, you can be appealed to using these economic justice principles, and say that you can offer things that aren't hating Mexicans in a wall, but instead say, here's universal health care, and get people to vote for your candidate and actually be able to get those policies in place. But Democrats act like soliciting those votes is a sin in and of itself, as though Obama didn't win a lot of those voters once or twice that ultimately went and voted for Trump, as though there's some like essential sin that came from voting for Trump, where all of these like newly minted deplorables are out here in the world that weren't the same old establishment Republican voters that of course voted for Trump because, hey, they want the Supreme Court justices who's going to give them the next Citizens United.
Right. Listen, like, of course there are a lot of racists in this country, and obviously Donald Trump's presidency has really, anyone who thought that we had moved on or whatever, probably feels a little bit foolish now, but I mean, yeah. It's been there. It's always there. But I do think when you're talking about that high, like that amount of people, 63 million people who voted for Trump, like we're dealing also with like a significant portion who are just ignorant. Like, and I mean that in a way where, like, you know, they can be like they could see the light. They could be, you know, I think a lot of people in this bubble that we live in, this, you know, this political, this activist, this social justice bubble, you know, it's sometimes I think we forget that the majority of people who go out and vote on election day really don't know all the little, you know, the little things that have brought up to this point, the events, the moments, you know, the language. I think a lot of people just, I think that's what it is a lot of the times.
I think that's of course true. People are informed at different levels, but I think that's true on both sides of the aisle. And a lot of people who weren't terribly informed voted for, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know,
right.
What I do think that, you know, even people who aren't informed, you know, can be reached. And I don't think that, I think that it's kind of the job of politicians. I think that's like an easy out sometimes for politicians. I think it's your job to communicate with people who don't have time to spend their whole day on Politico. And I think that the working people, what I saw was that people at all kind of information levels seem to understand that Bernie Sanders is a good guy and who is a guy who's fighting for them because he has a certain consistency of message that shows that he's genuinely attentive to what people want. And I think that a lot of what doesn't get discussed enough about the Trump phenomenon, and what was revealed to me, like, once again, watching Bernie Sanders do a town hall in, I think, West Virginia that was moderated, this is a while back, maybe last February, that was moderated by Chris Hayes.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, that was really good. It was really good, right?
And, you know, during that talk, you know, they had a room full of coal miners and coal miner families. And, you know, Chris Hayes asked the room, you know, who here actually thinks that Trump is going to bring back big coal? Nobody raised their hands. They're not stupid, right? They know that he can't snap his fingers. They know that they're in a dying industry. They know. But when Bernie Sanders asked the coal miner who was on stage with him why then, you know, he supported Trump, he said, look, at least Trump saw me and recognized that I was a person who was hurting with needs. He acknowledged what I'm going through, and I'll take that over the person who makes a glib gaffe and says, you know, we're going to kill big coal, or who seems to approach them with disdain.
Well, he pretended to care about them. Let's not give him too much credit.
No, of course he was pretending. But answer me this, and I said this to my colleague at work. I said, you know, if I have a sunburn. I'm dealing with some post-vacation peeling right now. if I have a sunburn and somebody comes up to me and says, oh my gosh, are you okay? Like, that looks really painful. Like, I'm really sorry that happened to you. And then leaves me and goes and gets some regulation that takes all sunscreen off the shelf. Versus another person who sees me suffering and pain from a sunburn and goes, ugh, serves you right, and slaps me on the arm. And then walks off, but doesn't do anything bad to the sunscreen. I can still access sunscreen or aloe or whatever I need. You know, it's not to me irrational to connect something, a positive feeling to the first person and ignore the kind of bad act that they do out of my eyesight, and then really discredit the bad act that the person did to me, to my face, and not credit them for protecting my right to sunscreen or aloe down the line.
Right.
And I think that's human nature. And it's absolutely not something. It's something that it's a politician's job to be attended to, and not something that I'm really comfortable criticizing voters for.
Right, right. So when this event happened and that BuzzFeed reporter tweeted out the abbreviated version of Bernie Sanders' quote, and this whole thing happened, I tweeted trying to explain what he was saying because I actually went ahead and watched the video and everything. And your Bernie Sanders tweet has reached the 8%ers when a bunch of white suburban men and women start tweeting at you to listen to black people.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like my entire career in journalism is basically premised on this insane way that identity politics has been weaponized in the most bizarre way. And I feel like as a black woman, it is my kind of obligation to leftists to throw my hat in the ring because, you know, I benefit from it.
I just want to say I'm so glad that we had like a mind meld there and you saw what I was trying to segue to, because I absolutely have a few of your articles up on my screen right now that you've wrote about identity politics that I want to get to because they're brilliant.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you.
So basically, in this article here that I have in front of me right now is titled How Identity Became a Weapon Against the Left. And I want you to walk us through that, because if you had shown me some of the stuff going on now, I would say in 2015, early 2015, I would actually be like, are you kidding me? This is really going to happen. I don't believe it.
Yeah. So we all remember 2016. We remember that there was a Bernie bro mythology that got to be so intense that, you know, Leslie Lee, who has a podcast Struggle Session, came up with the hashtag Bernie made me white, because it got to the point where the very concept of being a person of color or a woman who was a Sanders supporter was so anathema to people that I've had people accuse me of being secretly white, or in lieu of that, when they see that I have podcast videos and I'm actually a moving non-figment of a black person, that I must have been raised by white parents. That was my favorite. I said that all the time, but I just can't get over that somebody went there.
I'm just trying to like think, like, what is your game plan if that's going to be your opening right there?
Well, so what's what that is about is the idea that you have these people who are centrists who consider themselves to be basically on the complete left, as, you know, as liberal as they can be. They're not used to people actually being to the left of them, and they value being liberal, right? So that creates dissonance for them. And what has happened is that there has been this association of, having identity as a person of color or as a woman or as an LGBT person or any other number of identifiers as having kind of an intrinsic ethical value, right? So what has happened is if you are Black, you are correct. If you are a woman, you have ultimate authority. Whereas the original concept before it got bastardized was that I'm a Black person, so obviously I have insights into the experience, what it is like to be Black. I'm a woman. I have insights and experience of being a woman that are likely to make me more informed and knowledgeable than someone who's a man. That doesn't mean, though, that because I'm a woman, I can, you know, I have deep knowledge of, abortion case law, or that I can rattle off the Planned Parenthood scores of everyone in the Senate, or that I'm an ultimate authority on all things related to women's issues. You know, the theory should be akin to if I meet a plumber, I'm not going to, you know, plumber-splain to that person what it's like to unclog a sink. But there, it is possible in this world that I might have some knowledge about some fact of plumbing that this fellow doesn't know. Maybe I took a school trip to Versailles and learned about, you know, antique plumbing systems and have a factoid or two that this guy doesn't know about. But people have completely bastardized this concept of kind of privilege and familiarity and intersectionality to mean that your identity is more than just a proxy for your beliefs, views, and knowledge, but it in fact is like a fundamental fixed quantity. And so what you had then was people who, this was, I guess, actually probably in 2017, when people were talking about who was going to run against Trump, and names like Kamala Harris were being thrown around and Cory Booker, there were some criticisms of these party people for real reasons, right?
Right.
Their
Kamala Harris, former federal prosecutor, Cory Booker, basically Wall Street's best friend. In fact, I just want to bring up something. I just want to bring up something, actually. The people who, and this is a little bit off topic, but not so much. We're moving a little bit. Not to make it all about Cory Booker now, but one of the weirdest things to me, you know, these guys who hate Bernie Sanders for taking so long to endorse Hillary, he endorsed her in the summer. The real general election campaign didn't even kick off until, I would say, September. Hillary basically – oh, I would say Hillary almost took the month of August off, actually, if you remember their campaign schedule then. So the whole – one of their things is that Bernie took so long to endorse her, and it wasn't even a ringing endorsement or whatever. But if you remember – and these same people love Cory Booker. They think he has a real shot of being one of the – he's the future of the Democratic Party. But if you recall in 2012 – one of the major lines of attack from the Obama campaign and the Democratic Party was Mitt Romney and his association with Bain Capital. And weeks before the general election, I'm talking the election is in early November, Cory Booker goes on one of the Sunday morning shows late October, weeks before the election. Maybe weeks is being generous. Maybe no more than 1 or 2 weeks before the election. And he criticizes that strategy live on air network television on the morning shows. He says he says that they should lay off the attacks because of Bain and the finance industry. He doesn't like that. He thinks it's wrong.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Yeah, exactly. But
look,
just
I'm sure Cory Booker is like a nice guy or whatever. But like, I'm so tired. And look, I can say this because I have this very similar kind of academic background. And I'm like, I'm one of these people in theory, like by resume. But all of these like corporate elite, Ivy League, you know, Harvard bro-y guys, of course he's going to defend Bain because everybody he knows, everybody from school works at Bain now. Like, did he work for Bain? or advise it, Bane? I feel like he did, but I don't want to lie.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
But the point is, like, the world is. I can sit here on my phone and like pull up like 17 people who work at Bane right now. Like, that's just the world he lives in. And it was such an obvious kind of like a reflection of his like personal status and background and kind of belonging to a credentialed elite world. It was so tone deaf, but he gets a complete pass. Partly, you know why? This is. I'm gonna get myself into a Bernie Sanders moment.
Go ahead.
You know, it's because that identity acts as both a sword and a shield with certain people, and it's true. And look, that's not to say that identity isn't also often a burden, right? And that, of course, you know, people like Barack Obama were dogged constantly because of the fact of their identity. But the fact that liberals, and I want to say in particularly, like you mentioned with the people on Twitter, it's often white liberals who are using the identity of other people of color as a weapon and saying, here's what this black person over here said. You've got to listen to them. You're not allowed to have an opinion. That is so dangerous. And what's crazy to me as a black person who has politics that are, you know, different from some other black people, because it turns out that we're not monolithic and are allowed to have varying views. There's this crazy like dissonance that happens when I'm like pit against somebody else's black person, and sparks start to fly because they don't know how to process the fact that we're both black and we have different opinions.
Right.
And, you know, it should be fairly obvious that what should come first is an analysis of what somebody's views, beliefs, opinions, ideology are. And that should, of course, is going to be informed by who they are and what their experiences are. But if they don't have those fundamental qualities first, then the rest ultimately is just window dressing. And it's a point that was very poignantly made, actually, by, again, the black mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, toward the end of the talk, where he says there was a time where the goal was to have leadership that looks like us. And now it's time to look for those who think like us.
Right. I think also people need to understand that, you know, our criticism of, and Bernie Sanders' criticism of identity politics is not the same as the right's criticism of it. Like,
yeah, it's not even a criticism. I don't even like to characterize it as a criticism, right, of identity, yeah, politics. Because as I say in my article, the first paragraph, I write all the ways in which tracking identities, acknowledging that there are racial gaps, understanding how identities inform perspective is all very important. My critique is of weaponized identity.
Right, and bad faith use, yeah, of it. Yes.
Exactly. It's a bad faith use of identity in order to win political arguments that can't be won on the underlying substance.
Right. No, because really all politics is identity politics. I think a lot of conservatives don't seem to realize, and I'm not telling you anything new, obviously, but I think conservatives don't realize that a lot of the things they advocate for and a lot of their beliefs have to do, you know, when they go to the voting booth, they vote for the white guy sometimes. A lot of the times, because
all the time,
because they're white.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's all this stuff about, you know, we're a Christian nation,
right?
We just want to keep our demographics the way they are. Like, they're constantly saying, talking about working class Americans, as Hillary said, real Americans, hardworking white Americans.
Right.
Whatever that quote was, I'm not ready to let any of it go. I'm sorry. I'm having a petty day. It was a long day on the Twitter.
So before we wrap things up, I want to talk for a little while more about some of these critiques that I saw online about this event, because I think these are a lot of the critiques that I've seen of Bernie Sanders and his supporters over the past 2 years or so. And, you know, it's ramping up again. I guess they really are scared that Bernie is going to actually be a threat in 2020.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite is that, and you bring this up in an article of yours in Current Affairs, Bernie Sanders isn't a Democrat.
Yeah, thank God I wrote that article. So I don't have to argue with people about that anymore. I can just drop the link.
Right. But I got to say, every time they tweet that to me, I'm blown away. I forget. I forget Bernie's not a Democrat. It's like, oh, thank you. If it wasn't for you telling me every 5 seconds, all 100 of you.
Yeah, I mean, this is funny because it actually relates to what we were just talking about, because it's gotten to the point where political identity has become more important to people than the principles which are supposed to undergird the politics. So people think that by saying Bernie Sanders isn't a Democrat, that somehow means something about his value, his ethics, his integrity, what he believes in, whether or not his beliefs align with my own. It's almost like, someone 200 years ago calling someone else a heretic. Oh my gosh, they're not a Christian, which today sounds crazy. Like, okay, well, a lot of people can be good people and believe in all kinds of things or not believe in anything at all. Like, why are you saying that? Like, it matters to me. But a lot of people out there believe that somehow he has taken advantage of the goodwill of the Democratic Party or the Democratic Party's good name, which, doesn't exist, and that he somehow isn't owed anything by the party, and that he should either join in and pay his dues, although it's like a union, or get lost. But the same people would say, if he ran third party, oh my gosh, you're splitting the vote. Why are you doing this to the Democrats?
Right. It's like they want to cut off their nose to spite their face.
Exactly.
It's always that. And they still call him a spoiler to this day, which is hilarious because he is literally not the definition of what a spoiler is. He didn't run in the general election. He endorsed her.
Right. And more people voted for Hillary fans voted for or refused to vote for Barack Obama in 2008 than Senator Sanders fans, Bernie Bros, whatever you want to call us, declined to vote for Hillary Clinton, significantly more.
Right. Before they were
those Pumas.
Before they were Bernie or bust, there was Pumas.
Right.
And Party Unity My Ass.
Yep. And Obama Boys, they used to call them, which has some interesting racial valences.
Right. And I just want to add, because I do know that there are some Hillary people who listen to this, Hillary supporters listen to this show. This isn't all Hillary supporters. I know a lot of people who supported Hillary who think this subgroup of still with her resistance liberals are insane. Just like I think the loony left, I don't even want to call them leftists, but that's what my good pal, and I know you know him, Michael Brooks has dubbed them, the loony left. The dumb left, the H.R. Goodmans, those types. I criticize them. I think they're crazy too.
Yeah, well, Michael Brooks and I have had our dust ups over that because he's mad that I advocated voting for Stein if you're in a blue state or a red state. But I have good reasons, and I think I even had to get Michael Brooks to come around to that logic. So
right. I think we would have I think I might be on the Michael Brooks side of that one too. But we'll save that debate for another day. This is unity on this show right now.
This is the Chapo Unity Tour.
Right. So let's get to this next one that I love that I always see. And that is that Bernie Sanders is a narcissist who makes everything about himself.
Yeah, that one bothers me more than I think a lot of them.
Because it's patently false.
It's like the opposite of what's true.
Right.
It's not just a lie. It's like if I, went up to like Mother Teresa and was like, you're like an active like serial killer. Like it just completely is swinging in the opposite direction. There were some issues with Mother Teresa, but never mind.
Right. She actually might be an active serial killer.
I was looking for an example, but like, there's no one left who's pure these days.
Right.
When I got a chance to talk to him, on Wednesday, I really was impressed with the fact that it does feel like he's doing this because he feels like he has to, like he owes the people something. I think my impression is that he would be thrilled if somebody came along who could pick up the mantle and who had the same kind of name recognition and could, have the same chances that he had. And if he didn't have to run, if he could go home and spend time with his family and grandchildren because he's 76 years old, There is nothing.
He never had. You could just tell. He never had national, like in terms of presidential or just even a national figure. He never had those aspirations.
Right. You don't go to Vermont.
Right. Yeah. Like he is a U.S. senator, but he's from Vermont, and you can, and he's always been out there speaking on issues that affect, you know, working people and the left on a national scale, obviously. But he always sort of knew his place and just how much he can get done. He always, from you his earlier speeches, and it's pretty much, I'm going to speak out and try to get my voice heard, but I know I'm just one person speaking here to hundreds who don't agree with me. And my voice won't travel, but at least maybe I can represent those people who do know who I am. Right. But now a lot more people know who he is. And I think he realizes that, you know, he has a new responsibility.
Yeah. I don't know how many ways a person can telegraph that they're humble. They don't comb their hair. They wear kind of like average messy suits.
Right.
They, you know, and it's particularly galling given that a lot of these people, again, I don't want to make everything about Hillary. I don't have any particular animus toward Hillary Clinton. You know, I don't think that she was the best candidate for president, but I've
said before, and anyone who thinks I'm just a Hillary hater, if literally the Democratic nomination in 2020 came down to Cory Booker and Andrew Cuomo, I would go online and beg Hillary Clinton to run because I easily would vote for her over voting for them. Like, I would consider not voting at all if it was either one of them, but I would vote for Hillary Clinton again.
We'd have to talk more about exactly what. Well, I don't know that I feel that strongly. An example of just Booker.
where my criticisms of her lie.
Yeah, but, fair enough. But, you know, compared to Hillary, though, in terms of people who are at times self-aggrandizing, who have displays of kind of like, you know, a lot of personal ambition. And, you know, that's always when you bring that up with respect to Hillary Clinton, you're accused of being sexist because a man with ambition gets to have ambition and a woman doesn't. You know, this isn't a criticism, but to the extent that anybody in this party is ambitious and wanted to be president for the sake of being president more than any ideal, you might want to look to the person who had a pseudo campaign slogan that was, it's her turn.
Right. They were shopping that as a tagline. Right. And again, this is also, like we were mentioning earlier, just proof that these Bernie critics don't actually listen to his speeches like probably you and me do, but especially during the campaign season. I went to all but one of his like six New York City stops when he practically visited every borough but Staten Island. and, you know, one of the things he constantly said was, I cannot do this alone. This is not about me. It's about us.
Right.
That's the words of a narcissist, though.
Yeah, it's deeply confusing. You know, he even waited to run to make sure Elizabeth Warren, he confirmed that Elizabeth Warren wasn't going to run before he announced his candidacy because he wasn't in it to be the guy. He just wanted the ideals out there. And if she was going to carry the mantle, then he was happy to let her do it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. He again, did not want to run. I don't know how much we could drive that home to some of these 8%ers. But let's get to this one, which, you know, this one really bothers me. And it's that, you know, Bernie Sanders left Brooklyn to go live in Vermont because apparently Brooklyn was getting too black for him back when he lived there, and he wanted to live amongst his fellow white people or something like that. To me, that has always been the craziest, because anyone who knows the story of why he moved to Vermont, it's literally like anyone who lives in Brooklyn now can say, yeah, that's exactly what I would do if I was in his position. The idea that he went to Chicago to go to school and protested against the segregation in the campus housing during the civil rights era and came back to Brooklyn apparently and saw what desegregation looked like and said to himself, I've made a big mistake. I need to get out of here.
Yeah. It's like, you know, young Jewish man decides to leave Brooklyn to find his people in Vermont.
Right.
Like, that's the logic. And that's logic.
For people who aren't familiar, the story is that he was a poor kid living in Brooklyn, went to school in Chicago, was an activist in Chicago during the civil rights era. There's pictures of him tied up or chained to other protesters. And then after school, he comes home to Brooklyn. Him and his brother, you know, they're poor. And their parents have died. And they have this small inheritance, small for the time, I guess. And they're living in Brooklyn and they're in Manhattan or something, walking by. And they see at the time Vermont was having the state of Vermont was having a campaign to get people to move to Vermont. And they, you know, states do this. And they saw that with their inheritance, they can buy a decent plot of land in Vermont and not live as poor as they were living in Brooklyn. Still poor, still, you know, living off the land. They, you know, that's what they would end up doing. But they would have a slightly better life in Vermont. So they used that money that they got from this inheritance and moved to Vermont. That's literally the story of so many people today, even whether you're black, white, whatever. It's like, like people are getting pushed out. That's what happened to them. They got pushed out.
Yeah. It's a working class story and nobody wants to hear it because class, you know, class doesn't matter to certain people. I mean, we get accused. A lot of people on the left get accused of being class reductionists. And saying that class only matters when we're saying that both class and race matters. But what I hear a lot out in the world is from race reductionists who are so obsessed with, I shouldn't say obsessed because of course race is incredibly important, but they're so singularly focused on what the racial concerns are of the day that they have a complete blindness to anybody who might be suffering any class consequences, which erases the whole subcategory then of you know, poor white people. And you know, it's a difficult subject to talk about because anytime you talk about poor white people, it does feel like you're not acknowledging how much worse people of color have on the whole, numerically and as a matter of magnitude in this country. And I really want to say that that's absolutely true, but it doesn't erase the fact that the majority of poor people in America are white, and we can't have conversations. We can't build coalitions if people are offended by the acknowledgement of the existence of poor white people.
Right. And you know, one of the things that the 8%ers like to bring up based on that is that time Bernie Sanders said, and he said it wrong, but I truly believe, actually, from knowing his beliefs, that it was a slip of the tongue and he misspoke when he said that white people don't know what it's like to be poor. What he meant is that white people have white privilege. So while they know what it's like to be poor, they don't experience the same things on top of being poor that black people or Latino people do.
The conditions and quality of poverty are different because there are different race affects how it's expressed. That was a gaffe. And I think that this can be a teachable moment for any Bernie haters that are listening who might still be Hillary acolytes, that it's possible to admit that your man or woman or person did something wrong.
Oh, I criticize Bernie Sanders for plenty of things. And in fact, I remember early on in 2015, when those two Black Lives Matter protesters interrupted him in Seattle, and all these Bernie Sanders supporters were knocking them and defending Bernie and saying they shouldn't have done that or whatever. And I, on Majority Report at the time, had this whole thing where I thought, you know, later on, as I learned more about those two specific activists, I didn't so much agree with them specifically. But what they did, I had no problem with. Because, Bernie Sanders did have a blind spot. We've went over the reasons why, but that doesn't make it okay. And he had a blind spot, and it needed to be called out. But the difference between how Bernie Sanders handled it later on, and I agree he didn't handle it great in the moment either. I can absolutely say that he handled it poorly in the moment. But the difference between him and other people is that later on, once he was able to sit down with his campaign and realize and take in what just happened, they realized, they need to fix this. And they did a lot of things to try to address it.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. There's also this weird notion that, like, if you ever concede there's any flaw to your candidate, then that therefore means the other candidate wins. When in the real world, you have a set of options, right? And the idea is you still want the best candidate of the options. It's not like only the perfect candidate gets to survive. So people will criticize Bernie on certain things. You know, his, you know, gun record is something that people like to talk about a lot. And it's like, okay, let's assume that your representation of everything that you're saying is completely right. And I agree with you as a matter of policy that he has been too lenient on the gun industry and he has a low or a high NRA rating, whatever it is. You know, I can completely agree with you on all of those things and be disappointed in him for those characteristics, for taking the stances that he's taken. But if the sum total of his platform and ideology is still superior to the alternative, I'm gonna still vote for him.
Right, and we've seen that he can be pushed on issues too, though. Right. Like, and he is being pushed on guns too. And I criticize Bernie on guns. That's another issue that I think he's terrible on, or was terrible on. He's clearly moving in the right direction, and that's great because I want someone that we can push. And but even then, though, these 8%ers, they have a completely reasonable argument right in front of them on the gun issue. They have plenty of actual lines of criticism on guns, but they have to go even on the issue of guns to the extreme that isn't even factual anymore when they say something like he's bought and paid for by the NRA and all this. It's like, what are you talking about? It's why would you do that to you? Even if I was like on your side, I would say to you guys, why are you ruining my strategy here? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, it's like the odd Bernie bro who's like calling the Hillary people bitch and stuff on the internet. It's like, chill, dude, chill. You're ruining it for all of us. Right.
So there's one thing more to get to here. Well, there's a lot more, but let's go with one more. I don't want to hold you forever. And although I could probably relitigate this whole past 2.5 years with you tonight.
I'm sure the listeners will love it. Nobody's tired of that at all.
I gotta say, though, every time I do think I'm tired of it and then something like this happens, it's like I'm reinvigorated and it's like February of 2016 all over again.
it's keeping us young. It's like our own personal Groundhog Day. I haven't had to use moisturizer since the election.
And this is the most recent one I saw, and this article is not by Jamil Smith, but I saw it from his tweet. Mm-hmm. And the article is a Washington Post opinion piece called "No, the Democratic Party Isn't Divided or in Disarray," and it's by Paul Waldman, and it's a piece about what happened that night. And I do think a little bit of it is reasonable, and I do think a little bit of it is unreasonable, but the line Jamil Smith pulled is so shocking to me, and I think is easily the worst part of that article. And bizarrely enough, he decided that this was the piece to promote and quote, this piece of the article to promote and quote, and that is this line: "There will never be a point where Sanders says, I'm really pleased with where the Democratic Party is right now. Because once he said that, there would cease to be any need for Bernie Sanders to exist." And I read that, and I could not believe what I was seeing. Like, why would you ever, anyone, right, left, whatever you consider yourself, why would you ever say that about your political party or any political party? I'm really pleased with where insert party here is right now. Do you know why the corporate class and the lobbyists get all the things they want? Is because every time they get something, every time they're given what they said they wanted, the words that follow that write-up is, okay, insert politician here, what have you done for me recently? And they go ahead and go for their next thing that they want.
Right.
They never say that. There's no lobbyist, Walmart, Amazon, Google, ExxonMobil, no one there ever says, wow, we just got that tax break? this is great. The Republican Party is right where we want it. Like, no, they're saying, we want more from you. Otherwise, we're not going to fund you guys anymore. Give me more, more, more.
Right, right. Yeah, and, like, you know, the idea that the voters don't deserve as much as those lobbyists and that they should be satisfied with their lot in life and where the what the Democratic Party has done for them is frankly offensive. You know, if there's one poor person in America, if there's one food insecure child, you know, if there's one, you know, the teachers in Washington went on strike today because they got to school and none of the toilets were working. There was no plumbing and they had special needs students that they were expected to walk two blocks to go and use toilets at an adjacent school. I mean, if there is one person without health insurance in America, you know, if there's one person incarcerated, drug possession or even a violent crime for 25 years where their whole life gets wasted away, you know, then we shouldn't be happy with where the Democratic Party is right now, because the Democratic Party isn't done doing their damn job. And frankly, should be embarrassed and humiliated that the person who wrote this should be embarrassed and humiliated, and the person who retweeted it, Jamil Smith, should be ashamed that he would put this up and associate it with himself.
Like, especially now, though. Like, can you imagine taking a look at the political reality we live in right now and seeing a Republican-controlled House and Senate, a Donald Trump administration, conservatives being appointed to courts on all levels, local, state, federal, and saying, I'm really pleased with where the Democratic Party is right now.
Donald J. Trump is president of the United States of America. But Jamil Smith thinks we should be really pleased with where the Democratic Party is right now.
But they also have this really weird, these 8%ers, these people who just can't get over the fact that the Democratic Party should be and needs to be criticized. They just can't get over the fact that politicians are not like anybody else. They really are not.
Yeah.
They're public servants. They're not employees where, like, you know, you need to congratulate them when they do something good so they continue to do hard work for you. They have this bizarre characteristic where they have the power of your employer, but they are your employee.
Right. It's how all employment actually should be if we got cooperative like Sanders wants.
Right, right. But you wanna thank a politician, do it when they've retired and done inflicting harm or doing bad, then go ahead, thank a politician. If you absolutely cannot live your life without saying, thank you, Harry Reid, or thank you, John McCain, at least wait till they're done inflicting any possible pain they could possibly inflict. Because to me, it is bizarre. If the current democratic socialist leftist platform of universal health care, $15 minimum wage across the board in the nation, everything we possibly wanted, if all that came true, then even then it would not be thank you. Even then it would be, okay, next we want $20 minimum wage across the board. We want even more stringent climate change action. We want this and this and this and this and this. It should continue forever, because until poverty is eradicated, until racism is no more, until sexism is no longer an issue, which will never happen to any of those things, but that's my point, until all that is gone and we are literally living in a utopia, then I will never ever say, I am really pleased with whatever, insert here, is right now. And that includes a world where a Bernie Sanders would be president.
Well, you know, Matt, you just sound like a cranky millennial who wants a pony, and you just got to grow up. Because this is how the world is, and your suffering is irrelevant.
It's my selfish, narcissistic qualities coming out.
Maybe it's not all about you. Stop being a narcissist. You Sanders narcissist.
That's my version of, it's my turn now. vote Matt Binder 2020.
I put you in. I'll write you in.
Thank you. You'd be a wonderful vice presidential pick. So there you go.
Yeah, get some color on that ticket. It matters these days. I mean, it always matters. I don't want to be too glib. Of course, you know, that kind of stuff matters too. The point is that it's not it doesn't matter exclusively.
Right, right. Of course. You know, I think that that tweet by Maple Cocaine on Twitter is, mm-hmm. is, you know, most people who are on Twitter know this tweet. And I think it's the perfect example of, like, obviously more women and more minorities, Black, Latino, Asian, Native American. It's always great to have diversity. But the liberal, the centrist liberal version of it is, you know, they see the private prison industry and they say that we need more women guards.
Yeah, you got to say it with the emoji claps.
We need more women guards.
You're right. yeah, it's like this is kind of what I was saying about the, you know, we get accused of being race reductionist, but like they're out here completely ignoring class and being we get accused of being class reductionist. They're out here being race reductionist, and there's this of course it's both. You need to be doing both so you don't end up with either of these worlds, because neither of these worlds is ideal. But they're basically holding up a world in which there's perfect racial equality, but we have the exact same number of people who are poor and suffering that we have now, against a world where there's no poverty, no suffering, no people dying of sickness, being uninsured, or not being able to afford their medical bills, but the kind of racial hierarchy remains the same. And they're very, very confident, it seems, that the first world is superior to the latter. And as much as a Black person who has Black like my father graduated from the first integrated class from his high school in Virginia in 1976. You know, like, no one can sit here and tell me that I don't care about racism and the consequences of a specifically race-based hatred. I also have family that is very low income and that suffers a lot from the effects of poverty. And if I had to snap my fingers and have a choice, in world one, my family could still end up in the poverty hunk, randomly right. distributed racially in the poverty hunk. In world two, nobody's suffering. And so the idea that you're going to, you know, be a race reductionist to me is equally dangerous and not something that we should let these centrists get away with.
Right. I mean, they're the ones who always bring up intersectionality, and they're the ones who aren't intersectional.
Right.
They're the ones who minimize class. We're the ones, right. The left are the ones who are saying, no, race, sex, sexual orientation, gender, class, it's all equally important. You can't talk about one without all the others. They come together as a package. We're the intersectional ones.
Yep. Class is an explicit and essential part of the intersectionality analysis as it was innovated by Kimberly Crenshaw. And the fact that centrists have erased that component is galling, frankly.
Breonna Joy Gray, I cannot thank you enough for joining me tonight. I feel like after the week that just happened with this stuff, this was like therapy.
I'm glad you think so. I've got to log off and like draft up an article about all this stuff. So I'm feeling really high key right now.
you may need to also, after you're done with that article, invoice my insurance company.
I very well may. I'm going to start with a beer though and see if I can save you some medical expenses, because I don't know if you've heard, but healthcare is expensive in this country.
Right. Just see what they cover, and then just whatever they say I have to cover, just write that portion off. Just write that off.
I appreciate it. You're a real champ.
I'd love to have you on again. Have a good night. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Oh boy. Well, if my two or three tweets about this event led to tons of angry Twitter replies from those 8%ers, including one person who sent numerous emails, I'll describe them as passionate, I guess. None that I replied to. I'm sure this near hour and a half long episode on the topic will go over just as smoothly with some of those same people. But if for some weird reason you are one of those same people and bizarrely don't like this episode, I just want to assure you that even if you hate listened to this show, you should definitely also tell all your friends to hate listen to it too. Hell, leave a hate 5-star iTunes review. And there's nothing that would hurt my feelings more than if you would hate subscribe with your hate-filled $5 over at patreon.com/mattbinder. Folks, we're going to be forced to relive the 2016 primary for all eternity, aren't we? Well, see you all next time on Doomed.